watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is on Welcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In the summer of 1999, following a 7-year drought, temperatures in central New York hit the 100-degree mark, and many crops were lost from the heat and lack of rain. Many people experienced dry wells. During the 2000 planting season, there was so much rain that at planting time, many fields were a sea of mud. Our forests and vegetation were able to absorb most of last year's heavy rains. Not so for the people of West Virginia, whose land has been devastated by mountaintop removal coal mining. A bitter irony for people of those communities, as we'll hear in our first hour, is that these extreme weather conditions are the consequences of global warming caused by the burning of fossil fuels, mainly coal. Climate scientists agree that immediate steps must be taken to move to non-carbon energy sources such as solar and wind power. Yet the Bush administration has sponsored an energy plan that resembles a high-stakes poker game on the Titanic. In the second hour of the program, we'll hear about a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists that lays out a blueprint for a clean energy program, which could have been, but wasn't, put forward.
Lucky, lucky, lucky.
Lucky, lucky.
I'm Chris Sturr, and you're listening to Unwelcome Guests. On July 8th of this year, floods devastated southern West Virginia, killing 2 people and leaving hundreds of people homeless. More than 20 counties were affected, entire towns were nearly washed away, and there was property damage in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Later in July, there were more floods in West Virginia and in eastern Kentucky. Government officials and experts have attributed the floods to natural causes, excess rainfall, and the region's rugged terrain. But the areas affected by the floods are also the coal fields, where for over 100 years coal companies and their workers have extracted coal from the earth. First in underground mines, later by means of strip mining, and most recently through a new extraction technique known as mountaintop removal coal mining. The song you're listening to is called Rookie. It was written and sung by the Malian singer Ali Farka Toure. The lyric, sung in the West African language Sorhai, is, "Beauty is inborn, nature is best left alone." Over the next hour, we'll see why many of the people affected by the recent floods in the coal fields of southern West Virginia have come to believe that the devastation of the region should be attributed not to nature, excess rainfall, or rugged terrain, but instead to the coal company's destruction of nature and the government's complicity in that destruction.
Rookie, rookie, rookie.
Rookie, rookie, rookie.
Can't come hand on, rookie.
Rookie, rookie, rookie.
What is mountaintop removal coal mining? Regular listeners of Unwelcome Guests will remember a program we did last year, almost exactly a year before the recent flooding, on coal mining and its effects on the environment and on communities. Here is an excerpt from that program in which Randy Boyd, an activist from the Plateau Action Network, a West Virginia environmental group, explains the basics of mountaintop removal and its environmental effects.
West Virginia for the last 100 years has either led the nation or been in the top 2 or 3 states for production of coal. And back in the 70s, a new type of mining started up. It was called strip mining, basically where they go to an area and take large bulldozers, strip all the topsoil off, and get the coal. And here in about the last 10 or 15 years, technology has increased to where they take off the whole tops of mountains. Sometimes they'll take a 3,000-foot mountain down to 2,000 feet. And it's usually just thin layers of coal, but what makes it so bad is they might do that to get 2 feet of coal, but they have to take the other 998 feet of what they refer to as spoil and put it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And where they put it is in the streams and the hollows and the valleys, mm-hmm. and that's called valley fill. And for instance, the machines that they use to do this, the typical drag line is 30 stories high, mm-hmm. and the bucket that scoops this material up is 3 stories high, bigger than a 2-story house. Wow. It's about $100 million machine, and it's just devastating the environment, devastating communities, and flattening our mountains. And West Virginia is the mountain state. That's our heritage. It's mountains.
Right. How might mountaintop removal contribute to flooding? Mining sites include structures such as dams, sediment ponds, drainage ditches, and slurry impoundments, which are supposed to contain the liquid byproducts of mining, that may be vulnerable to damage by flooding. If those structures are damaged, the resulting runoff, which in some cases may contain dangerous toxins, can increase flows in streams, rivers, and valleys, and thereby increase the severity of flooding. But it's hard to see how the regulation of such structures alone would be enough to keep mountaintop removal mining from contributing to flooding. The deforestation of tens of thousands of acres, the dumping of rubble into valleys, and the resulting diversion of hundreds of streams is itself likely to exacerbate flooding. Water, which would otherwise have been absorbed by topsoil and plants, or carried away through the natural system of tributaries, instead increases floodwaters, carrying with it the debris that has been unearthed by mining. Indeed, in the days following the July 8th flooding in West Virginia, inspectors from the State Department of Environmental Protection issued numerous citations of mining operations in the region, including cessation orders and notices of violations of state mining regulations. Under the regulations, the DEP is empowered to issue cessation orders when a mining operation, quote, creates an imminent danger to the health or safety of the public, or is causing or can reasonably be expected to cause significant imminent environmental harm to land, air, or water resources, end quote. According to the Charleston Gazette, at least 10 companies were cited for causing damage off their mining sites and for not properly controlling drainage from their operations. The mines cited were in precisely the areas hardest hit by flooding. Yet incredibly, in their public statements, state officials were still reluctant to attribute the extent of the flooding to coal operations. The DEP secretary, Michael Callahan, was quoted in the Charleston Gazette as saying, quote, "We're going to try to learn some lessons from this. We want to learn what, if any, effect the mining operations had on this specific incident," end quote. That is, on the devastating floods of July 8th. But Callahan also denied that the cessation orders his inspectors had issued meant that the department had concluded that there was a connection between mining and the floods, and even suggested that coal operations might have mitigated the flooding. Quote, "A cessation order has nothing to do with what impact the mining had on the flooding. The way some of these mining operations are set up, they stopped the flooding. They slowed the water flowing, and I think it could have been worse if they hadn't been there," end quote. By the Thursday after the initial July 8th flooding, under pressure from coal companies, the DEP had backed off from many of their citations and cessation orders, according to the Charleston Gazette. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for Bob Wise, the governor of West Virginia, said, quote, "There is no data or evidence yet, one way or the other," end quote, and that the governor would be, quote, "keeping an open mind," end quote, on the issue of whether mining had contributed to the flooding. There are reasons to believe that even if coal companies follow state regulations, the chances of flooding are increased. Federal regulatory agencies and citizen environmental groups have been claiming for years that the state DEP's regulations do not adequately address the potential contribution of mountaintop removal coal mining to flooding. First of all, in 1990, the state DEP's regulations were challenged by the Office of Surface Mining, the federal agency that oversees state's enforcement of the provisions of the 1977 Federal Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. The agency found that the DEP's regulation and design rules for runoff ponds were inadequate. In particular, the agency pointed out that state regulations required that certain drainage ponds be able to withstand only 10-year 24-hour storms, whereas federal guidelines require that all drainage ponds be able to withstand 25-year 24-hour storms. These are measures of the statistical likelihood of storms and floods of different degrees of severity. The July 8th floods were at some places considered 100-year floods. The agency ordered that the department come up with new rules by 1992. Those rules still haven't been written. When DEP Secretary Callahan was confronted with this fact at a press conference soon after the July 8th floods, he responded by saying, quote, "I'll take a look at that, but it's not going to be soon. Right now we're dealing with an emergency situation," end quote. Yet it seems likely that the emergency was in part the result of the DEP's failure to look into revising their regulations as required by the Office of Surface Mining. More recently, earlier this year, several citizens groups filed a lawsuit challenging the DEP's regulations governing what kinds of studies of water flow coal companies must do in order to receive mining permits. At issue were the cumulative hydrologic impact assessments required by the Federal 1977 Surface Mining Control and Reclamations Act, which must include a study of, quote, "water quality descriptions, including information on seasonal flow rates, variation, and usage," end quote. In connection with the Arch Coal Company's application for a permit to expand one of its mines, the lawsuit charged that the DEP allowed studies that were not sufficiently stringent. DEP representatives testified that the permit they issued to the company was state-of-the-art and rigorous, but the citizens groups charged that the studies were based on measurements taken for less than a year, which could hardly have measured the seasonal impact of the mining. The DEP also didn't require measurement frequent enough to adequately assess the impact of flows on streams near the mine. According to the Charleston Gazette, Robert K. Simons, a hydraulic engineer testifying on behalf of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, said, quote, "To understand hydraulic processes, one would need to collect data on a fairly frequent basis. Something on the order of hourly might be required for some period of time to see how the watershed would respond to a particular storm event," end quote. Simons testified that a full year's measurements and frequent measurements would be required to adequately assess the impact on surrounding streams during storms. He estimated that equipment to collect such data would cost about $2,000. The judge in the case, Robert C. Chambers, ruled with the DEP and the coal company, stating, quote, "To some extent, the dispute about the regulations typifies a battle of experts, each expressing with varying degrees of specificity and assurance what standard should be followed. While more data is preferable, the court again declines to impose plaintiffs' recommendations as a standard inherent to the DEP's duty to require and consider baseline data. The regulations require water quality and quantity descriptions which include information on seasonal flow rates and seasonal variations, end quote. But the judge ruled the DEP has discretion to determine what information counts as adequate. The upshot is that the DEP could require coal companies to do year-long frequent measures of the flow rates and seasonal variations in the water level in streams affected by their mining operations before issuing permits. Such studies would cost the companies little. If such studies had been required for the mines in counties affected by the July 8th flooding, the DEP might have been able to predict that the operations would increase the chances of flooding. But the DEP refuses to implement such regulations, and a judge refuses to force them to. Could it be that such detailed studies would reveal that mountaintop removal coal mining inevitably exacerbates flooding? A final piece of evidence supports just this suggestion. My account has drawn heavily on the excellent investigative journalism of Ken Ward Jr., a reporter for the Charleston Gazette. Through the Freedom of Information Act, Ward uncovered thousands of pages of the draft of a federal study that showed that mountaintop removal mining in the very areas hit hardest by the July 8th flooding could substantially increase peak storm runoff. The study, which was conducted by the Office of Surface Mining and Army Corps of Engineers, was required as part of a federal lawsuit settlement in 1998. The Department of Justice promised that the study would be released by the year 2000, but the project has been delayed repeatedly and no results have been formally published. The study found that drainage areas and valley fills from mountaintop removal mines could, in some cases, increase peak runoff flow by 42%. The summary document accompanying the study seemed to downplay these remarkable findings, stating that, quote, increases in peak flow did not cause a rise in water level overtopping the receiving stream channels. Flooding typically occurs only when water levels exceed channel capacities and spread across the floodplain where residential settlements may occur, end quote. But according to Ken Ward, these summary statements, quote, were not contained in the actual flood study documents prepared by the OSM and the Corps. It was not clear who added them to the summary document, end quote. It should not be surprising that federal officials would downplay the findings that mountaintop removal can dramatically increase the risks of severe flooding and that they would bury the study, given President George Bush's new energy policy, which calls for increased reliance on fossil fuels, including coal, for the production of electricity. Indeed, according to the New York Times, Bush's home state of Texas is the country's largest coal consumer. The new energy policy has been promoting the notion of clean coal, even as the coal industry has adopted the slogan, quote, energy from coal, essential, affordable, increasingly clean, end quote. But according to the New York Times, in 1999, coal-powered electric plants put 18 million tons of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides into the atmosphere. These are major contributors to acid rain. Coal plants also pump 2.3 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere each year. This is twice what cars put into the atmosphere. President Bush's support of and by the coal industry fits perfectly with his rejection of the Kyoto Accords, which would require reduction of the release of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. Another aspect of President Bush's energy policy is relevant to the coal industry. The Clean Air Act of 1977 does not cover older coal plants whose emissions of greenhouse gases and toxins are therefore greater. But President Bush is calling for review of the regulations mandated by the Act, which restrict the amount of electricity that can be produced by the older coal plants. The greenhouse effect has further ramifications for West Virginia, since global warming has also been thought to increase the incidence of storm events involving severe flooding. So residents of the West Virginia coal fields are harmed by coal both at the stage of its extraction and at the stage of its consumption in the production of electricity. Last week, I spoke with Vivian Stockman, outreach coordinator of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, located in Huntington, West Virginia. We spoke about the connections between the July 8th floods and mountaintop removal, and the complicity of state and federal government in allowing coal corporations to endanger communities and the environment in West Virginia.
Maybe you can start by describing the recent floods of July 8th, and then there have been more recent ones since then.
On July 8th, large areas of southern West Virginia received heavy rainfall in a short period of time. Now, the rain gauge measurements are still coming in, but in the Whitesville area, they received almost 5 inches in a matter of a few hours. And the Whitesville area is where my organization has worked mostly since the floods. And we've talked to many people in that area who've lived there all their lives, elderly people who had never seen anything like this before. They'd said they'd seen that type of rainfall in a short period of time, but never the massive destruction from the floods. People there described trees coming down gullies and standing upright, and boulders just cascading down the mountains. And the rain was running off from mountaintop removal sites.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could start in with the next question, which was about mountaintop removal and what it is. Then you can talk about why people might draw this obvious connection between the mountaintop removal and mining and the flooding.
Okay. Mountaintop removal coal mining is practiced most heavily in southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky. That's where the coal that underlies the ground is buried in thin layers, very deep. So what they do with mountaintop removal is literally blow the tops off the mountains. They blow up to 800 feet off the top of a mountain in order to get to these thin seams of coal. So it's nothing at all like underground mining. And a coal company will decide that they want to get to this coal by mountaintop removal method. Come in, they'll strip all the forest off. And you have to understand that this forest is one of the most diverse, biologically diverse forests on Earth. It's a mixed mesophytic forest and has a great diversity of species of trees and understory plants. So they just annihilate that, and we're talking about huge swaths, say around Cayford Mountain, which is this one lone mountain that's left in a sea of mountaintop removal. Surrounding that mountain is 10,000 acres of mountaintop removal. Hmm. So they'll decide, okay, we flatten the forest, and now we're going to come in with explosives, and they use explosives to just blow the mountains to smithereens. These blasts use the same material like was used in the Oklahoma City bombing of the federal building,
mm-hmm.
and the blasts are 10 to 100 times more powerful than that, and they can take place anytime, day or night, and there's been fly rock that has flown off these sites into nearby communities down the mountains. It's just a miracle that no one has been killed by this. The blasting alone is a major problem for coalfield residents because their houses get cracks in the drywall, the foundations get cracks, their water wells dry up, they lose their water, and they have to put up with dust, and this dust is heavily laden with silica that's coming off the mountaintop removal sites, and that's, what causes black lung disease. And just the noise and the stress of having the mountains around you blasted into oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
And once they've got the overburden, as they call it, removed from the mountains, they have these huge machines that are up to 20 stories tall, these drag lines that take giant bites out of the earth and pick out the coal and take the rubble and dump it into what used to be the valleys. So the scale of the operation is incredible. You can see it from outer space.
Mm-hmm.
Coal companies like to tell you that, we've only mined 1% of West Virginia's landmass in that way. Well, they're counting all of West Virginia. There's some areas of West Virginia that have no coal. There's some areas up north where there's only deep mining. But in southern West Virginia, 20 to 25% of some counties has been mined in this manner.
Wow.
So we're talking about gargantuan mines that you can actually see from outer space, according to the astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have incredibly accurate figures because, you know, the coal companies themselves and the Department of Environmental Protection really don't supply them. The last time we had the USGS surveys for that area was in the 1960s. But estimates are that at least 500 square miles of West Virginia's southern mountains have been mined in this manner, and about 1,000 miles of streams have been buried. And these are headwater streams that are absolutely crucial to the biology of the downstream rivers. So we're just turning West Virginia, southern West Virginia, and eastern Kentucky into the nation's energy sacrifice zone. Burying the streams with these tons and tons of rubble, and it's not just like a thin coating. There's a former valley now becomes almost a mountain. The valley fills themselves can be up to 200 feet high. And this is in direct violation of the Clean Water Act. And West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, a group that my group works with closely, filed lawsuit over this. And the lawsuit was settled, except for a certain point, which was that the valley fills violate the Clean Water Act. And that part of the lawsuit went on to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which said that, you know, that we were in the wrong court. They cited the 11th Amendment, and it was a real political screwy situation that's pretty complicated, but we're probably back to ground zero as far as having to start over and sue in state court over the federal law, or have the decision appealed to the Supreme Court. So a Republican federal judge had agreed with this environmental group that, yes, indeed, this valley fill practice violated the Clean Water Act. And basically he said that, you know, what the coal companies are doing is obliterating these streams. And his decision was not overturned by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal, but basically we were told we were in the wrong court. So now there's all sorts of lawsuits against all the various violations of the surface mine law that the coal companies are doing here in West Virginia, so there's ongoing litigation, but the fact of the matter still is they're violating federal law by burying these streams like this. And one reason people are thinking that the mining, this mountaintop removal mining, has contributed and worsened the floods of late, well, it's really basic environmental science 101. Forests hold water. Vegetation holds water. Soils that are healthy hold water. I read a figure somewhere that 100 mature trees, and I'm not sure what age they're saying for a mature tree, but 100 mature trees can hold back a foot acre of water. When you scalp all the vegetation off and leave compacted soil, you're going to get drastically increased runoff. It's not rocket science, it's just common sense. And the Office of Surface Mining conducted a study. Now, this was a study they were forced to do out of part of the settlement of the major lawsuit with the Clean Water Act and the valley fills. They were forced into doing an environmental impact statement. Several different agencies are having to do that. That environmental impact statement on the effects of mountaintop removal is long overdue, and the only way we know anything about it is because the Charleston Gazette did a Freedom of Information Act procedure in order to get 40,000 pages of documents. And within those 40,000 pages, the Gazette reporter Ken Ward found the OSM studies on mountaintop removal's effects on flooding. And they specifically studied three different groups. Now, that those reports are not published as part of, because of political carryings on within West Virginia. And they are published, however, on the Gazette website. And if you look at those, they have a particular study of the Princess Beverly Mine around Cayford Mountain near Whitesville, West Virginia. And that study found that the mountaintop removal greatly increases flooding over pre-mining activity. So the government already has the studies that say, yes, indeed, you know, when you remove the vegetation, when you compact the soil, you are absolutely increasing the runoff. Mm-hmm. And the coal industry, one of the major apologists for the coal industry is Bill Rainey. He's president of the West Virginia Coal Association. He's saying, he's going around saying, well, yeah, anytime you have any kind of human activity, you increase the runoff, and the coal industry just shouldn't be a pariah about this. This flood was mainly an act of God. Well, he's being, let's say he's carrying out his public relations function, because he's talking about a small, say, strip mall or something that could be maybe up to 100 acres versus something that's 10,000 acres.
Right.
Or huge, these huge sites, and many of them lap up one against the other. So he's trying to downplay the size and the effect of these things, as the whole coal industry is just trying to say basically that it's an act of God. But any of the residents down there, ones that have never spoken out against mountaintop removal, are now really upset that the coal companies continue to blame God for this, and they're all saying it was an act of coal. And if you look at the flood debris, you'll find chunks of coal in it. You'll find huge boulders that obviously came off the blasting sites. One lady even found a sign from the mine site itself in her yard.
Wow.
And I did a flyover of Fayette County and looking at the damage after the flood. You could see areas where valley fills had lost their hydro seeding, and hydro seeding is just this kind of mixture that they spray on, a grass seed mixture that they spray onto the denuded areas and pretend like that's reclamation. And you could spray your car with hydro seed and it would grow on it. But this latest flood, I could see from the air where all their little green hydro seeding had been washed away by the deluge.
Huh.
So there's plenty of evidence, and there's one lawyer that's going to start a class action lawsuit, and so far hundreds of people have joined on with him, because everybody knows that, you know, those huge swaths of land that are deforested and deformed are no longer operating in their, you know, forested condition, which would have been to hold back great quantities of water. There's no doubt that it was a lot of water in a short amount of time, and that the topography of the area is very steep, and it is prone to flooding. But lifelong residents will tell you there has never been any kind of flooding like this until the mountaintop removal operations moved in upstream.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to read the quotations from people from the coal industry and sometimes government officials in the articles from the Gazette, when they say, you know, the cause of these floods was excessive rain. I mean, they're just, it seems as if they have this PR task of denying what is obvious to people.
Industry exerts enormous political power in West Virginia, and it has for over 100 years. Mm-hmm. And the DEP, you know, we like to call it, instead of the Department of Environmental Protection, we like to call it the Department for Every Polluter, but they are especially solicitous to the coal industry, and they're buddies with them, and there's quite a few good people that work within the DEP, but they're frustrated by the higher-ups who are so obviously kowtowing to the political power of the coal industry.
Yeah, so maybe you can talk about it sounds like after the flooding, DEP inspectors did issue citations for mines, but then they tried to backtrack from that?
Well, I don't know exactly where those citations stand right now, but yes, the papers did report that they issued them, and then they backtracked somewhat. What you have is the field inspectors, who are real good folk, who are out there, and they're seeing what's happening. They see where a drainage sediment control pond failed in the last rain, or where part of a valley fill failed in the last rain. So they're out there on the ground. They see the effects. They issue the citations. And then the higher-ups are going to get pressure from state politicals and politicos and probably Senators Byrd and Rockefeller even, and they have to back off somewhat. And they make silly statements that you see like, well, yes, we're out issuing citations for the flooding-related problems, but that doesn't mean that mountaintop removal contributed to the flooding in any way. Mm-hmm. So there's doublespeak all over the place. But and now the DEP has formed a study to see if, well, mountaintop removal does in fact cause worsening of floods. So even though the OSM already has the study out there, the DEP wants to study it just in the typical bureaucratic delay, delay, delay fashion. Mm-hmm. And you can bet that there's been behind-the-scenes political pressure exerted on the higher-ups in DEP to sort of back off. And the West Virginia governor, Bob Wise, has been saying, well, it could be. I want to keep an open mind about this. Perhaps mountaintop removal did increase the flooding, but we're not going to go on any witch hunt here. So he's saying he wants to keep an open mind, but it's more like he wants to keep an empty mind. He wants to be empty of the knowledge of, you know, what coalfield residents have lived and what they know.
It's funny that in the articles that I've read, that they talk about the details of when citations are given. It's often for these technical departures from certain regulations, but not necessarily in recognition of the huge effect on, you know, the deforestation will inevitably have, you know, on a tendency to flood. Does that sound right to you? That, I mean, maybe you could talk about the ponds, like there are these drainage ponds that and dams that are supposed to be
well,
protected in certain ways.
People in West Virginia have been really upset about these coal sludge impoundments.
Mm.
Now, there was one that started really the whole Surface Mining Act when it burst in 1972 and killed 125 people. That was the Buffalo Creek disaster. And that was the first time that there was national attention given to the fact that, you know, the coal industry is going to call this an act of God. But from that disaster came the surface mining
mm-hmm.
laws that are supposed to be in place and enforced today. Now, the coal impoundment structures today are better engineered than that one. Still, in October, one had a leak at a mountaintop removal site in eastern Kentucky, and at least 250 gallons of this black, disgusting, toxic, heavy metal-laden coal sludge, this is the waste left over from cleaning the coal, 250 million gallons of that stuff escaped into the waters along the Kentucky-West Virginia border.
Huh.
And, I mean, the area is still reeling. Aquatic life was annihilated. And so every time it rains in West Virginia in the southern coal fields, people who live below these type of impoundments are petrified. There's one near Whitesville, West Virginia, which at its final stage will hold 5 billion gallons of slurry.
Hmm.
That is equivalent to an aquarium, quote-unquote an aquarium, about the size of a football field, and higher than Mount McKinley or Denali. So, I mean, you're talking about a huge amount of this black sludge. So none of those, that's what the coal industry and the DEP have been running around going, well, none of those failed. None of the coal sludge impoundments failed in this July 8th flood. Okay, none of those failed, but the downstream ditches and smaller ponds that are supposed to help control the runoff and the sediment from that pond itself, some of those did fail. One valley fill at least failed partially. And, you know, these are structures that we're going to be living with for long past seven generations, which if we had any sense, we'd be considering seven generations ahead. Uh-huh. And so they did have overflows and releases of what they call black water. That is where this coal sludge waste, there were releases of black water. There were no complete failures, but there were plenty of cases of overflows and the things that are supposed to protect people breaking down.
Uh-huh.
And this is what some of the citations were about.
So here's my question. My question is about one of the things I noticed in the standards and the regulations that they've had for some of these structures that the coal companies have to have, the standards they have to meet for their structures associated with the mines, that they have to be able to withstand a 25-year flood.
The structures are supposedly designed to bear what they call a 25-year flood event, which is a pretty massive event. Obviously, the structures did not do well in this last round of floods, which has been called a 100-year flood. So that begs the question, are these structures designed adequately to withstand the kind of flooding that we've just seen, and that the kind of flooding we can expect to see more of, more often, mainly because global warming or global climate change is real and is happening and is producing more intense storms all around the world. So it's kind of ironic that one of the major sources of the global warming gases is, of course, the combustion of coal. Mm-hmm. And here in West Virginia, we're suffering twice then from the combustion of coal. Number one, in the mining, in the extraction of that coal, which gives us mountaintop removal, and up north it gives us the deep mines and all the acid mine drainage. And then number two, we've got global warming that's going to be intensifying the storms and therefore intensifying the mountaintop removal effects, which are intensifying the flooding. So we're in a really vicious cycle.
Yeah, my understanding was that the 25-year and the 100-year flood event standards are supposed to be statistical, but then if you're starting to see, you know, 100-year flooding events with, you know, as great a frequency as you've been seeing it down there, then that means that the statistics have, you know,
need to be modified,
and so do the regulations, but also this is a wake-up call to notice the changes in the environment.
Well, that's what they're saying down in Whitesville. Hey, if you're calling this a 100-year flood, how come we have had these kind of floods? We've had several over the last couple of years. Of course, the July 8th was the most intense as far as property damage and total destruction. And then, you know, within July, there were two more really heavy storms. So obviously, both the regulations and the statistics are off as global warming increases these intense storms.
Yeah, so speaking of global warming, maybe you could talk about how mountaintop removal and the activities of the coal companies are connected with President Bush's energy policies.
As far as I'm concerned, President Bush is what the Charleston Gazette has been calling President Select, and who selected him was the fossil fuel industry and really helped fund his way into office, not even to mention all the shenanigans in Florida. And Bush did carry West Virginia, and a lot of people have been saying, well, that's because the coal industry is so powerful here, but other people have been saying that's only because of the National Rifle Association. Either way, his more, drill, mine, and nuke the guts out of the planet energy policy has huge implications for West Virginia. There's a major push out of the legislation that the House just passed for so-called clean coal. And what they're talking about with clean coal is, you know, maybe we'll remove some of the sulfur dioxide, maybe we'll get rid of some of the nitrous oxide and cut down on some of the acid rain. Well, burning coal is just one small aspect of the true costs of coal. And, of course, they're not even mentioning the carbon dioxide and its contributing effects to global climate change. And they're not mentioning the mining, the extraction of the coal, and what a heavy price we pay in Appalachia for that. They're not mentioning the cost of transportation of coal, where you've got train tracks going through these poor Appalachian communities spewing out dust because the vehicles don't even need to be covered. They're not talking about the trucks that transport coal and just pound the hell out of the infrastructure, costing the state more money. They're not talking about what happens after you burn the coal. You have the ash to dispose of, and that's contaminating groundwater. Wherever there's a power plant, you can be sure there's ash, a pile of ash sitting there, and it's leaching into the groundwater. And, you know, they're not mentioning mercury and the host of heavy metals that are associated with the burning and disposal of coal ash. Mm-hmm. And all those kind of things are things that damage our immune systems, our brains, our genetic potential. So to talk about clean coal and to promote more coal use is, in my view, ecocidal at this point. They're going to be throwing billions and billions into this so-called clean coal research out of the Bush energy policy. And meanwhile, Europe is contemplating a law that would double their amount of renewable energies by the year 2010. So we're sitting back here with this fuel that was outlawed 500 years ago in England. Yeah, there was a king, I can't remember his name. I can remember it's, I read this in John McPhee's The Curve of Binding Energy, which is about nuclear power. Uh-huh. But on page 69 of that, there was a thing where he cited a certain king in England who outlawed the use of coal because even then they could see that the black smoke was too poisonous to be burning in London.
Huh.
But then they chopped down all the trees and they said, oh, well, maybe, you know, it's a little black smoke. So we're stuck with this dinosaur fuel that's turning us into fossil fuel fools. You know, we're going to be promoting that while the rest of the world is just completely embracing alternative energies. You know, if so, that's how the Bush policy really makes West Virginia suffer. It keeps us tied to the yoke of King Coal, who has not brought prosperity to West Virginia. We're talking about one of the poorest states in the nation, and the coal fields are the poorest counties in the poorest state in the nation. And the only thing that is keeping that in power are government subsidies and the political power itself of the coal industry, which contributes heavily to both Bush and all of our congressional representatives and on the state level, our politicians. So as long as we have that kind of corrupt special interest influence within the political system, you know, King Coal is going to hang on tightly to West Virginia.
And in West Virginia, that's both Republicans and Democrats. That
oh, absolutely. Are, yeah. You can barely tell the difference between the two as far as the promotion of coal and the coal industry is concerned. Granted, the current Democrat governor is not a former coal executive like was the last Republican governor, our last governor, and he pays a little more lip service to protecting the environment, but so far he's really just been towing the coal company line.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see, to finish up, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about how what the activism around these issues has been like in West Virginia, and I mean, you said that a lot of people who hadn't been against or vocally against mountaintop removal are really now speaking out in the wake of these floods. Do you expect there to be a lot more activism around these issues?
Okay. My group, the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, has been active since like 1987, but we only started into the mountaintop removal issue about 4 years ago. And we got involved in the issue because Coalfield residents came to us and asked us for help. They were fed up with the DEP, getting no response there, getting no response from state politicians. And it was obvious to them that, you know, there needed to be a concerted voice of the Coalfield residents and political pressure. What our group does is a lot of organizing within the Coalfield community itself, and we work very closely with a group called the Coal River Mountain Watch, and they're based in Whitesville, West Virginia, and they have many Coalfield residents, and they probably have quite a few new Coalfield resident members since the last round of flooding, because the problem with speaking out with the coal against the coal industry in West Virginia is the incredible political power and the intimidation tactics. If you live in a coal field town, you will feel incredible pressure if you speak out against the coal company, and you might even be intimidated and threatened. But I think more and more with groups like ours, like OVEC and Coal River Mountain Watch, people are feeling empowered to feel like we can unite together, we can speak out, we will not be intimidated, we are going to take control of our future. And we try to do fun things, like we have protests. We'll sometimes go to the DEP office and protest outside there. There's known to be a certain King Cole who appears as a person in an outfit that's dressed up like a fat cat fella and hands out fake coal cash, and we've had candlelight vigils and prayer services at the governor's mansion. We've taken busloads of people to D.C. to meet with our representatives, and often out of other states' representatives, because ours really just, you know, they don't even care about the citizens. It's so obvious they're strictly tied to the coal industry interests. And we try to help give people arguments to counter coal industry propaganda. Coal industry will say, hey, if you stop mountaintop removal, there'll be no jobs left in the coal industry. Well, that's a complete lie. Those huge machines, one machine replaces like 500 men. Mm-hmm. So, and since there's been more and more mountaintop removal, production of coal has been increasing while the number of jobs plummets. So we try to give people factual information that they can use. We try to give people fun events to attend and let politicians know about their outrage so that we can show our numbers to politicians. We also promote campaign finance reform because, you know, that's the underlying issue here, is that we're not going to get any help until we either get people from, say, upstate New York writing, you know, having their senators exert pressure on our senators, or until we get, you know, until we vote the bastards out through campaign finance reform.
We will give people contact information at the end of the show about what they can do. I mean, you've already said that one thing that people can do is write their members of Congress to tell them to oppose mountaintop removal. But besides the Bush Energy Plan, is there any upcoming legislation that people could focus on?
Well, that's going into the Senate. You know, the House just passed there, so the Senate will be working on the energy plan, and I think that would be a good thing if people could say, you know, there is no clean coal. Put that money into alternative research. Cut out the clean coal. There is no such thing. Get some jobs and manufacturing alternative fuel cells directly into West Virginia's southern coalfield communities. Other things people can do is write letters to the editor. We plan on another trip to D.C. soon. We haven't got that scheduled yet, but we want to bring more Coalfield residents back to D.C., and we will definitely be needing the support of outside senators and representatives at that time. because we just can't get any satisfaction with our own.
That was Vivian Stockman, Outreach Coordinator of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, located in Huntington, West Virginia.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.